Coming up next is Zoe Harcombe, and she's going to be talking about real food and the nutritional ignorance that caused obesity. Zoe Harcombe's passion is obesity. She wants to reverse the obesity epidemic. She even jokes that she'll try world peace afterwards, but is deadly serious about the first goal. Zoe was the first pupil from her school to graduate from Cambridge University. While studying math and economics at this historic institution, Zoe set out to answer the million-dollar question, why do you overeat when all you want is to be slim? This became the title of Zoe's first book, published in 2004. Stop Counting Calories and Start Losing Weight followed in 2008, and this was a UK number one Amazon bestseller. The book she always wanted to write came out in 2010. The Obesity Epidemic. What caused it? How can we stop it? 135,000 words blowing apart many widely held beliefs in the world of diet and nutrition. Despite being counter to current thinking, the media have been intrigued by Zoe's research, and she writes regularly for national newspapers and magazines. She has also appeared on Fox News in the US and BBC News 24, and regularly on local radio in the UK and USA. You can learn more about her at zoeharcombe.com. Zoe, welcome to the Real Food Summit.
Thank you so much for having me.
Great to have you here. Really excited about this presentation. You've been on my radio show before, and so some of my audience has heard your story, which is an awesome story. For those who haven't heard that, can you tell them about your journey and what you do?
Absolutely. I mean, I'll go real short on the journey because we covered the journey in great detail last time. Key issues, I guess, or key events that developed my interest in food. The first one was my brother developing type 1 diabetes when he was 15 and I was 13, and that kind of introduced me to the world of insulin, glucose, blood sugar lows and highs. Then developed an eating problem myself in my teens, as so many, I guess, high-achieving girls particularly do, although it's more male now. That then developed into other problems, and I didn't realize at the time that anorexia has the highest death rate of any mental illness at 20%, which is just incredible. And for those who don't die from the condition, it's very, very common as a way out, in inverted commas, to actually develop overeating. The pendulum swings the other way. And that's where I found myself. And I was at Cambridge University studying maths and economics, just thinking, you know, what am I doing here? Eating all this food in just this insatiable way. And the first thing I therefore set out to do was to try to understand why people find themselves eating when they want more than anything else in the world to be slim. And that ended up becoming the title of my first book in 2004, Why Do You Overeat When All You Want Is to Be Slim? And at the time, I was actually an HR director. I was enjoying a very successful career with some companies that I, you know, now have an insider perspective of that, you know, I wouldn't perhaps be a fan of at the moment, Mars being one of them, the confectionery company, and SmithKline Beecham, a pharmaceutical company. But I did very well as a global HR director, executive vice president, whatever you call it. But the book then started to do quite well, and I put my email address in the front of the first book, and I started getting emails from people saying, you've changed my life. You know, you've stopped my food addiction. I don't crave food anymore. I feel like $1 million. I've lost weight. I'm keeping it off. And my publisher came back in about 2008 and said, look, you know, let's write another one a bit more mainstream, a bit less scientific, and that was Stop Counting Calories and Start Losing Weight. And that became an Amazon bestseller in the UK in 2009. So that was the time for me when I had to make a choice and say, okay, my passion is obesity. It always has been. I am fascinated by why we have an obesity epidemic in the developed world. And now's the time to stop the security of the nice salary and the pension and the 401k and the bonus and all the rest of it and to actually go out and do what I really love doing. So what I do right now, 7 days a week, I work very similar hours to you, Sean. You know what it's like. We get up really early and we read and we write and we talk about our passion, which, you know, for me is particularly the obesity aspect of real food. And for you, it's everything to do with real food and fitness and life and, you know, water and chlorine and, you know, everything that can make people healthier and better. So I spend my time trying to do what I can, my bit, to reverse the obesity epidemic. And if people are open-minded, I can help them lose weight and keep it off and gain health, as can a number of people out there, you know, Mark Sisson, Jimmy Moore, yourself. There are a lot of people now that you can turn to who will give good advice. And at the same time, therefore, I'm trying to expose the nutritional myths that abound, the bad dietary advice that we're feeding our fellow humans, And in doing that, I guess I have to do two things, because I've got to counter what the fake food, as I call it, industry are doing. And the two things that they need to do, first of all, they need to demonize the real stuff, because they need to make sure that we're not reaching for eggs in the morning, we're reaching for their sugary cereals. And then they've got to make up, you know, these daft health claims about their own foods. You know, some gunge has been put in, some gunge that might lower cholesterol. Not that cholesterol's a bad thing, we'll come on to that. And, you know, I've got to then counter those two things. So I spend a huge amount of time promoting real food and exposing these daft claims that are made about fake food. And like Kayla Daniel, for example, with soya, you know, I'll attack the hydrogenated spread, soya, sugar, white flour, all the stuff that the fake food industry is trying to get us to eat instead of what the planet provides for us.
This is the Real Food Summit. And so, of course, I have to ask you, what does real food mean to you?
Yeah, this is a really good one, actually, because when people come to the diet, this is one of the first questions that they ask. So I say, okay, oranges grow on trees, cartons of orange juice don't. Fish swim in the sea, fish fingers don't. You know, cows graze in the field, pepper armies don't. You can say about three things, and usually most people are looking like they've picked it up after about two. You know, if they don't, you carry on and say potatoes come out of the ground, you know, chips don't, fries don't. And they pick it up really quickly. So it's to get people to think, whenever you look at a food, is that in the form in which nature would provide it? Is that in its most natural form? If it is, the chances are it's good for us. And if it's not, the chances are it's bad for us. So you can get things that people think are provided by nature. So, you know, for example, wheat, you know, we're told to base our meals on starchy foods, which is the single biggest thing that's caused this obesity epidemic. So people will look at wheat and grains and think, oh, they grow in the field, you know, they must be natural for me. But then you need to sort of look at, where have they come in our evolution of the food chain? And, you know, if we've been around for 3.5 million years since Australopithecus Lucy first walked upright, then we've been eating any animal that we could lay our hands on, any fish, any bird, any mammal. If we were lucky at different times of those millennia, we would have got hold of vegetation or nuts or seeds. But, you know, dairy and grains only came in about 10,000 years ago. And when they did come in, they were so different to how they are now. You know, the William Davis book, Wheat Belly, I thought was absolutely brilliant. And he goes back to the earliest forms of wheat and talks about what that wheat actually was and how much it's genetically mutated over the last 100 years, let alone the last 10,000 years. And, of course, you know, being genetically modified and shortened and over-farmed and, you know, to the point that our bodies just can't tolerate it. So some people think of things as natural because they might grow in a field, but then you'd add in the caveat of how long have these been around. And the other thing that I want to get across talking to people about real food is it's like we've forgotten why we eat. You know, when you see the My Plate, that's the new plate in America, and we've got our own plate in the UK, which is quite evil, and you look at the stuff that they're promoting, and, you know, they continue to talk about grains and cereals, and you need all this fiber without actually being able to explain why. You know, when I studied nutrition, and like you, I learned much more about nutrition on my own than I ever did in any formal course. You realize that we eat because we need macronutrients and micronutrients. And the macronutrients we need are fat and protein. We could debate whether we need carbohydrate at all. And the micronutrients are the 13 vitamins, and there's some debate on minerals, but most would settle on somewhere around 16. And it's like we think these are optional. Nowadays, it's like, you know, we don't think about how much we would need to eat to get our zinc or our calcium or our B12. You know, we really do behave as if these things are optional, and they are not optional, and their deficiency can be life-threatening. We've recently in the UK had a four-month-old baby die of rickets, and the parents were accused of murdering the baby because the baby had so many broken bones, they could not believe that the parents had not been harming the baby. But the mother, for cultural reasons, had probably been vitamin D deficient, had passed that vitamin D deficiency on to the baby, and the baby never, ever had a chance. So it's the stuff that nature provides, and nature put in all the macro and micronutrients that we need for good reason, and we've got to go back to eating this kind of stuff.
Absolutely. You've blamed macronutrient confusion for the obesity epidemic. How does that work? Tell us more about that.
Well, what we've done done it right from the start. And this has been one of the bits that's most fascinated me. Now, you know, you'll have people that have a go at you, and I've got people who have a go at me. You know, I try wherever I can to find areas where we can agree. You know, I'm not looking to pick fights. I want to have heated agreements. And I'm thinking, if only we could get this confusion over saturated fat sorted out, maybe we could have a heated agreement. Because, you know, the dietary guidelines for Americans list ice cream, sherbet, frozen yogurts, cakes, cookies, quick breads, donuts, margarine, sausages, potato chips, corn chips, popcorn, and yeast bread as, you know, okay, sources of saturated fats. But they are first and foremost processed foods. They are secondly carbohydrates. Most of those, because I, you know, spend hours analysing these kind of things, are actually higher in unsaturated fat than they are in saturated fat. You know, not that one is better or worse than any other, but just to set the record straight, you know, they really, really are not saturated fats. So they condemn all of these foods. And these were foods that were also mentioned in the very first study that kicked this whole thing off. Everyone quotes it, the Keys seven-country study published in 1970. You know, Keyes also thought that cakes and ice cream were fat. He called meat and eggs saturated fat. They are, of course, mostly unsaturated fat. You know, it's been this nutritional ignorance that perhaps we could have excused 50 years ago, but it still prevails today. In the UK, we say the same: ice cream, sweets, crisps, chocolate, confectionery, cakes, pastries. That's what we call saturated fats. And, you know, we could surely agree that we should demonize these foods, we should ban them, we should tax them, do whatever we want with them. But because they are processed foods and not because of any real fat or quality products that they may actually contain.
Natasha Campbell-McBride, as well as a lot of other writers and experts and bloggers out there, say in terms of the heart disease hypothesis and whatnot you speak of, the case has just been kind of closed. It's like we don't even bother looking to see if there's any other truth out there, because saturated fat and cholesterol have just been convicted. You know, the case is closed. You managed to get the UK government to admit that the trial has never been done. Can you tell us about that?
I know, it's just incredible. I'm actually doing an article at the moment and, you know, talking to an editor of a major national newspaper in the UK. And, you know, he's saying, oh, but, you know, everyone knows saturated fat causes heart disease, or everyone knows cholesterol causes heart disease. And I'm saying, send me a study. And he sort of goes quiet, like, you know, are you nuts? And I'm like, I'm telling you, I will send you the letter from the UK Food Standards Agency saying there has been no study. And this goes back a long way. Now, Gary Tobes was one of the ones who really first laid it out for people, how far back we needed to go to show when the dietary advice changed. It changed in the US in 1977. It changed in the UK with a report that came out in 1984. And in this report, I've managed to get the original. It actually says there has been no controlled clinical trial of the effect of decreasing dietary intake of saturated fatty acids on the incidence of coronary heart disease, nor is it likely that such a trial will be undertaken. Now, that was in 1984. I then wrote to the Food Standards Agency when I started doing this obesity stuff full-time in 2009, and the Food Standards Agency wrote back and said, the ideal control trial for prevention of heart disease dietary trial has not yet been done, and it is unlikely ever to be done. Just hasn't been done. And the really, really interesting thing is, when you understand about nutrition, you understand why it cannot be done. And some simple facts about fats, which a lot of listeners of this summit will understand, but public health authorities don't, dietitians don't, you know, the nutritional ignorance that's out there. The number one most important thing that people don't seem to realize is that all food that contains fat contains all three fats. There are no exceptions whatsoever. So whether it's meat or seeds or fish or eggs or nuts or avocados, anything that's got fat in it has got saturated fat, monounsaturated fat, and polyunsaturated fat. And then you've got the fact that oils are the only foods that are 100% fat. You know, you then go into the macronutrients and say, sucrose is only carb, it's got no fat or protein. Oils are only fat, they've got no carb or protein. And then everything else, as you know, has got, you know, either carb, protein predominantly, or fat, protein, but they've got a mixture of the macronutrients. So if you're going to do a dietary trial trying to look at saturated fat, the only thing that you can do that won't change macronutrients is to start playing around with oils. And so then you do as an experiment. So, okay, let's say we take, we replace olive oil with sunflower oil. And what happens then is you'd very slightly reduce saturated fat, but you'd also reduce vitamin E and vitamin K. Sorry, vitamin E would go up, vitamin K would fall. And you actually swap out very little saturated fat, but you start playing around more with the monounsaturated fat and the polyunsaturated fat. And that's the only thing that you can do that doesn't affect macronutrients. Now, the other thing that people don't seem to know is that there is only one food group that has more saturated fat than unsaturated fat, and that is dairy products. You know, meat is more unsaturated, eggs are more unsaturated, fish more unsaturated, everything else is more unsaturated. So the only food group is dairy products. So, okay, you might say, let's replace 100 grams of cheese with 100 grams of olive oil. Well, okay, you reduce saturated fatty acids by 7 grams, but you increase MUFFAs, as they call them in the papers, the monounsaturated fats, 7 times. You increase PUFFAs, the polyunsaturated fats, tenfold. You also lose 25 grams of protein, 33% of your vitamin A, all of your B12 recommended daily allowances, your calcium, 70% of your allowance disappears, phosphorus, zinc, and so on. So, you know, you make one food change and you can set off a domino that has changed about 20 other things. And that's before you would then look at stress and smoking and exercise and lifestyle and are they happy in their job and are they having marital difficulties. You know, it is absolutely, fundamentally impossible to do a dietary study that would try to look at the impact of saturated fats on any health condition. And nobody seems to have worked that out. So the Food Standards Agency is quite right. The study has not been done. The study will not be done. So what we then get left with is basically just the epidemiological studies. And we know what happens when we're left with those because we have the 7 countries study that kicked all of this off. And you can hand pick your 7 countries or your 5 countries to suit whatever argument you're trying to put forward. And I could find 5 countries to show a relationship between fat and heart disease. I could find 5 countries to show a relationship between dog ownership and heart disease. I mean, you can show anything when you start cherry picking the data. So, you know, they won't be able to prove that they're right, but it's also making it very, very difficult for us to prove that they are wrong.
When I read your book, The Obesity Epidemic, I was blown away by a section in the book, and we actually talked about this last time you were on the radio show. And the part was where you had taken the raw data in the 7 country study that you just spoke of and found a virtually perfect correlation between heart disease and latitude. And it was much better than Key's correlation that he had with heart disease and cholesterol. And so have you been doing any playing around with those or any extra playing around with those numbers?
I have, actually. I mean, it must be the mathematician in me. I mean, I do love the numbers. You know, just to remind people who might have missed that one, what people don't realize is in the 7 country study, Key's actually never tried to quantify any kind of relationship. His conclusion is actually incredibly weak. He just said, you know, coronary heart disease tends to be correlated with cholesterol, cholesterol tends to be correlated with fat, fat tends to be, you know, it was very, very vague. And it was about 25 years later that he actually said, okay, I've looked at all the data now from, you know, back in the 1950s, and I reckon there's a 0.72 correlation between coronary heart disease and cholesterol. And the correlation for latitude was 0.96. I mean, it was literally almost perfect, which, of course, is really nicely explained by the idea that if you're in the countries close to the equator, you've got more sunshine on the skin, which synthesizes more cholesterol, turning it into vitamin D. So you've got lower cholesterol levels in the bloodstream, but that isn't a health factor in any way, shape, or form. It's just something to do with where you're living. And I was actually inspired by Malcolm Kendrick. I'm such a fan of Malcolm Kendrick. It's not true. The Great Cholesterol Con. And Malcolm had looked at some data for the MONICA study, the monitoring heart trends in Europe, cardiac incidents, whatever. And he'd done his own 7 countries studies, basically, and looked at correlations between fat and heart disease in his chosen countries. And of course, you know, you pick countries like France and Switzerland and Austria, and you show that the higher the saturated fat intake, the lower the heart disease, and the complete opposite to what Keyes was showing. And I was sat there, you know, one afternoon, just probably about a year ago now, thinking, well, you know, I could do the same looking at cholesterol data for the world. The World Health Organization data is so comprehensive. You go on their website, it's quite incredible. And sure enough, for all 192 countries in the world that they have data for, they have average blood cholesterol levels and obesity rates and heart disease rates. I mean, you know, the data is just incredible. So it took not even 2 hours, and I just got a big Excel spreadsheet, dumped all the data into it, and then basically ran a Pearson correlation coefficient, and then plotted it as a scatter diagram. And it was genuine research. You know, Einstein says, if you know what you're looking for, it's not research. I didn't know what I was going to find. I guess if you'd have stopped me before I started it and I didn't plan it, I'd have said, I think I'm going to see a scatter diagram that really hasn't got any pattern at all. It's 192 countries. That's a lot of countries in the world. You know, it's probably just going to look like a spider has crawled across the page. And Excel, of course, puts in the trend line for you. And the first one that I did was men and heart deaths. And the trend line was very slight, but it was down. So it was showing the higher the cholesterol level, the lower the death rate, and the lower the cholesterol level, the higher the death rate. Now, the R squared, which is the strength of the relationship for men and heart deaths, was really small. It was like 0.018, very, very small. I then redid it for women and heart deaths, and the R squared headed up to 0.3. And the line of thick really starts to show a gradient. I mean, it's really moving down from the left to the right. The higher the cholesterol, the lower the death rate. Then I did all deaths because, of course, there's a lot of people. I'm a member of the SINCS organization, the International Network of Cholesterol Skeptics. A lot of us see cholesterol as the most utterly vital substance in the body, incredibly protective, our main tool for cell repair, and therefore vital in cancer. And, of course, we're worried that when people are trying to lower cholesterol in the name of heart disease, they're actually causing more deaths in other illnesses. And sure enough, put in males and all deaths, all 192 countries in the world, the R squared became 0.43. And the trend line, I mean, it really is strongly downwards. Women, it's even worse. The R squared is 0.54. And, you know, the trend line, you have to see it. I've presented this at conferences, and there is an audible gasp in the audience as, you know, people are realizing, hang on, this is the diametric opposite to what I've been told. And you can just see their little minds ticking over saying, you know, what is going on here? I'm seeing this evidence from my own eyes. I've got no reason to doubt it. It's not cherry-picked. It's all countries in the world. And it's exactly the opposite of what I've been told. And they get pretty annoyed, actually. Some of them will come up to you afterwards and say, how can this be? You know, how can we be being told one thing when the evidence is telling us something quite different? And I think most of us who work in this field would have a quick answer to that one, which is follow the money. That's usually the answer that we give to find out why we're doing the wrong thing.
Absolutely. Follow the money. Every 6 months or so, there'll be a media report about how harmful red meat is for us. And there was just one that came out maybe a couple months ago that people were all up in arms about, especially the bloggers. You've been defending red meat in your blogs recently. Tell us about that.
Well, it's been going on for a while, actually. I mean, February 2011 was the first time that I needed to wade into it, and there was an article that was widely reported. It came from the UK, but I think it got picked up globally, and it was about red meat and bowel cancer. And the Scientific Advisory Committee on Nutrition, which is a body that will advise some of the UK public health bodies, it was the most incredible blog. I mean, all of these are on my website, zoeharcombe.com. If you just put in red meat on the search, you'll find all the blogs that I've done on this. They were asked very, very specifically to look at one issue, which was, if we advise people to eat less meat, would it have an impact on our iron intake? So it was actually a very good question that the UK government had asked of a scientific body to say, please go away and have a look at this. And they reported on this, and, you know, I read all sort of 80 pages of the report, and they'd done a pretty good job of saying, you know, yes, red meat is very rich in iron, you know, it would have an impact, but, you know, there should be a concern, you'd need to find other alternative sources of iron, and I think, you know, they'd even quite sensibly noted, you know, don't forget there's iron that's only of use to the body when it comes in animal form, you know, you can't just feed people spinach and assume that everything is going to be okay. And this whole query that had been asked of them ended up being reported in the paper as red meat causes bowel cancer. It's like, how on earth did you jump from what they were asked to do to that one? And of course, you know, you'll see so often a press release saying, you know, pigs can fly or something, and you go back. I mean, the one in January, actually, that involved, I think, Stephen Guiney, it was one of his first papers or something, and it was about rats. And they'd shown that when they managed to overfeed rats and enable them to gain weight, so basically, you know, the rats got more obese, and they were noticing changes in the hypothalamus. So essentially their conclusion was, if you can get rats to a state of obesity, it actually changes something in the brain chemistry and the way in which they operate. But because to get them fat, they fed them a different diet to the, you know, non-fat rats, the study, of course, picked it up as a high-fat diet is going to cause brain damage. You know, so they do this thing. They take something that actually is quite honest and well-reported and just twist it to say what they believe, which is, you know, red meat's bad for us, it's all going to kill us, and how we didn't die out 3.5 million years ago, I don't know. But the ones that have been doing it since are basically Frank Hugh, Walter Willett, and the Harvard boys. And, you know, Harvard should know better. I went to Cambridge. Harvard is the Cambridge of the, you know, Harvard and Yale, Oxford and Cambridge. They really should know better. And they've obviously got the nurses study and the health professional study, and they must just sit and play with this data 24/7, trying to spot correlations. So one came out in August 2011 on red meat and diabetes. And, you know, straight away your brain is going, what? You know, diabetes is a condition of the body's inability to handle glucose. You know, I'm thinking carbohydrates. I'm not thinking meat, which has got zero carbohydrates. Quite interestingly on that one, I spotted an error in their paper, which I think still hasn't been corrected. I did write to Frank here and he said they correct it, and they haven't yet. So these guys are certainly not infallible. But of course, you know, when they talk about red meat in the first line, they immediately switch to red and processed meat. They didn't take into account, were people eating burgers? Were they eating buns with these burgers? Were they eating ketchup with these burgers? You know, it's all just an association, absolutely nothing about causation. And then, of course, they had the big one in March 2012 where they pulled out the red meat and mortality. Again, the nurses study, again, the health professional study, again, association, not causation. And the really staggering thing with this one, I mean, had a really sort of minor version of the Denise Minger moment when she wrote her blog on the China study and suddenly had, you know, all these website hits overnight. I think she had 100,000. I think I had about 10,000. So it didn't quite have the same impact, but I was kind of in there quite early because it broke early during the day in the UK when people were probably asleep. And by the time America was waking up, I already had the blog up saying, hang on, you know, the raw data doesn't even go in the direction that they're saying. It's actually going in the opposite direction right up until the fourth of the five quintiles. You know, you haven't taken out the processed meat. You're calling hamburgers unprocessed meat. You know, there were so many errors with it, and I just sort of listed all of these out in the blog. Then did actually contact Frank Hugh, who did reply to me the first time and said, one of the things that I questioned was that they said that they'd actually removed every other factor for the data. But then, you know, as meat consumption went up, so exercise was going down, smoking was going up, I forget all the other components, but everything was going in the wrong direction. And it's like, well, how exactly did you mitigate for all of these so that you really can prove to us that you've isolated red meat or processed meat or whatever you think you've done? And Frank actually came back the first time and said, well, actually, it's really difficult because age overrode the data to such an extent that, you know, it really, you know, your first sort of move from quintile 1 to 3 or whatever, age is really dominating that data. So and I dropped him a note back and saying, well, you know, why didn't you say that age is a factor in mortality, which, of course, wouldn't be the headline, really, would it? You know, the older you get, the more likely you are to die. And then he never got back to me again. And, you know, Fink said, oh, it's because he's worked out you're not just a lay person anymore. You're actually someone who, you know, could harm his professional reputation, so you might not hear from him again. But I swear, you know, if these guys took that nurse's data and the health professional's data and they tried to run an association with the colour of socks worn or the American football team supported, they could find a correlation. I absolutely doubt, no doubt whatsoever. You know, give it to us and we'll find one in a couple of hours. They'd certainly find as much correlation as they are finding with red meat. And, you know, would they then come out and say, you know, wearing blue socks causes heart disease, or wearing red socks, you know, is going to increase your mortality, or supporting the Redskins is going to give you diabetes? I mean, it's just nuts. And these are supposed to be intelligent professionals working out of Harvard. Now, the key study, of course, that needs to be done is to take the paleo guys, eating pretty much nothing but grass-grazed meat and eggs from grass-grazed meat and fish and some seeds and nuts and vegetables and salads, whatever, and do a correlation on those people and what they eat and their health. But, of course, that would never tell the story that they want to tell, which is, you know, they want to condemn meat, animal foods, our heritage, what we have evolved to eat.
I love how thorough you are. Very, very thorough. You mentioned earlier, follow the money. What other obstacles to progress are out there?
Oh, I mean, conflicts of interest is absolutely the huge one. And there's ones you'd expect. I mean, you know, of course, the food in inverted commas and drink in inverted commas, you know, they are there to make money. We've got a big debate going on in the UK at the moment because we're literally months away from the Olympics, and major sponsors, McDonald's, Cadbury, which is like our, you know, your Hershey, massive confectionery company, Coca-Cola, and, you know, the real foodies are up in arms saying, how can you allow these people to have any involvement at all in a major sporting event? And the government just doesn't care. You know, we've had Lord Coe, who's the head of the Olympic Committee, saying, well, you know, how do you think we'd fund the Olympics otherwise? You know, we need this big money. And people are saying, oh, you know, McDonald's are doing it because it's a good event to support. No, McDonald's are doing it for two reasons. One, because they want to sell more product by having their name. You know, it's like Pepsi promoting Super Bowl. They want their name out there. And they want the halo effect of being connected to sporting events. You know, they want this association strongly implanted in people's minds that, you know, you can look at these elite athletes and be thinking about Coca-Cola and McDonald's at the same time. And what we need to make sure is that every time people are looking at Coca-Cola and Pepsi and McDonald's, they're thinking about obesity and diabetes and cancer and people bedridden because they are so large they can no longer move or function as human beings. But, you know, they'll do what they can to get that halo effect of being associated with these sporting events. Now, the drug companies, you know, and the symbiosis between the drug companies and the food companies is amazing because, of course, it's fantastic for the drug companies that we have fake food because it then gives us the diabetes and the Alzheimer's and the cancer and the heart disease and all the reasons to statinate people and drug them and give them all these other things that are just not in their own interest. So, you know, you start off with the ones that you'd expect. The bit that most surprised me when I did the research for the academic book, The Obesity Epidemic, What Caused It, How Can We Stop It, the ones I just didn't expect were the dietetic associations. You know, when I first found the sponsors of the American Dietetic Association, which reads like a who's who of the food industry, and you add up that their combined turnover was something like $467 billion, and you realize, you know, that is the weight behind the dietitians who then have a monopoly over in the U.S., certainly in 46 out of 50 states have a monopoly on giving out diet advice. There was some stuff going on in April of this year with a blogger who the American Dietetic Association were trying to close down because he'd found that a paleo lifestyle could really help with diabetes. And they were trying to say that that was giving nutritional information, which was their domain. And, of course, if it's then controlled by the food and drink industries, you know, they can make sure that dietitians are saying, have your Benacol, don't whatever you do, have butter, you know, have these low-fat spreads, have sugary cereal, don't for 1 minute eat eggs because, you know, eggs are going to clog up your arteries and kill you with their cholesterol or whatever. But then you go beyond the dietetic associations. I mean, I'm really careful now where I give money to charity, you know, particularly animal charities, because I wonder when the more aggressive of some of the vegan and the vegetarian organizations are behind some of those. The health charities you have to be really careful of as well. I mean, Diabetes UK has as its sponsors most of the drug companies, the sweetener companies, Canderel, Splenda, Müller Lite, Kellogg's, which is one of the major sponsors of the dietetic associations, and even Jelly Belly. You know, what is Jelly Belly doing sponsoring Diabetes UK when diabetes is a condition about not being able to handle sugar, glucose? And then, of course, you've got governments. And there are a number of people, actually, who are starting to say, you know, governments won't do anything about this because it's just not in their interest to do it. You know, they get the money from the taxation, from the food companies. You know, it's the same thing. We know that cigarettes kill one in two people who smoke, who are actually using the product as it's intended to be used by the manufacturers. You know, if, like, guns killed one in two people that sort of picked them up, I think the gun laws would have changed even in America. But, you know, we still allow smoking because they must have done the cost-benefit analysis that says, OK, we're getting more money from the revenue and we have to pay out less in, you know, care for the elderly because these people aren't making it through to old age. You know, I really do think they're doing some pretty calculated sums behind the scenes to say, you know, if kids are developing type 2 diabetes and they live younger than their parents, well, you know, we have a pensions crisis in the UK. There is no way we're going to be able to honour the government pensions that have been committed to the people retiring in 10 to 20 years' time. You know, if they do die off because they're obese and they've got cancer from the foods that they've been eating, then, you know, you can't help but think that the government does not have our best health interests really fundamentally at the centre of their policy. Because if they did, there is only one message that they could be giving people, which is to eat real food.
Absolutely. With all of these obstacles and all of this money and all of these this bad information and bad science, do you think that the obesity epidemic is ever going to be resolved?
Oh, that's a great question. I don't think governments will resolve it. You know, I do lobby and I do try and get involved in government groups, and I will continue to do so, just as will Sally Fallon Moran and Jimmy Moore and Tom Norton. You know, we'll keep trying. But I don't think the governments will change. There's just too much at stake in terms of the money and the sponsorship and the support that they get from the food, drink and drug industries. I think egos are too big for them to admit that they have been wrong all this time. And I think they really haven't worked out how we feed and employ 7 billion people on this planet without fake food. And, you know, I'm having debates with the guys in Thinks about this at the moment, and there's some very positive responses coming back from people like Barry Groves, Bjorn Hammersfeld, where people are saying, yes, I think we can. If we go back to using the grasslands in the way that it should be being used, replenish the topsoil, which can only be done with the animals grazing on that grassland, stop planting grains, certainly stop feeding grains to cattle, you know, let them do the cellulose digestion that they were designed to do, there is actually a chance that we could feed I don't know if it's 7 billion, but a large number of people in a healthy way. But the governments are not going to go back on those three things. So I think that this is down to individuals. And I do think Sally Fallon Morrell puts it beautifully when she says, it's no longer the survival of the fittest, it's the survival of the wisest. The people who know, who are open-minded, who reject the food plates and pyramids that our governments put in front of us, who listen to the people pushing the envelope like Tom Norton and Mark Sisson and are open to what these guys are saying, they will resolve their own obesity epidemic. And whether we make a tipping point will depend on just how many individuals come with us, basically. And, you know, I have good days and bad days. I have days when I think we're getting there. You know, the momentum is building. I see replies back on Twitter and you just think, you know, it's building. The momentum is there. And then you have days when another report comes out demonizing saturated fat from the World Health Organization or, you know, the National Heart Forum, and your heart just sinks again. So I guess my sort of final comment will be, I think we can resolve the obesity epidemic. I think we can reverse it. And it's up to us if we actually will.
Yeah, we're certainly moving in the right direction. People are getting more and more aware and educated on these matters because they want to be healthy and they're getting tired of bad information out there that doesn't work. Zoe, your website is zoeharcombe.com. When our attendees go over there to visit your website, what are they going to find?
Oh, blogs, loads of blogs, actually. Links to my books. The books are available on Amazon UK and Amazon US. And my sort of bio, my personal story, what I'm trying to do, and lots of comments on lots of the blogs. Not as many as Gary Toves gets, but, you know, a fair number. And like Jimmy, you get the nice ones, you get the nasty ones, you take the rough with the smooth. So hopefully you could spend a good few minutes there and enjoy some of the stuff that you see.
Outstanding presentation, Zoe. Really appreciate your time. Thanks so much for being part of the Real Food Summit.
Oh, thank you so much for having me again. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.